Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, it is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. We are live for the April 3rd edition of Pollock and Thurston, a packed show that we have coming your way today. How are you, Brandon? Are you all set for Philadelphia?
I am, as set as I was last week. You're going a day earlier than me, so I have another day to rest.
Yes, I am off tomorrow, and then you will be joining the festivities on Friday. We will be discussing WrestleMania week, some of the events that we will be going to, and other news and notes attached to the happenings. But we are going to be momentarily airing our interview that we conducted on Tuesday afternoon with Ann Callis, who is the counsel for Janelle Grant and representing her in her civil suit against Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE. And on the back end of that, we also have some statements from the legal representation for not just John Laurinaitis, but also from Vince McMahon that we will be sharing as well. So this stems from Monday's New York Post story that was put out, and it contained a 2,000 or so word love letter that was written by Janelle Grant, dated December 24th of 2021. And from the story, it reads that a woman who alleges she was sexually abused for years by Vince McMahon wrote a gushing love letter to the former WWE CEO in which she declared the duo was, quote, in love with a capital L, end quote. And she now claims that McMahon coerced her to do it, the Post has learned. Janelle Grant, whose bombshell lawsuit landed a day before the wrestling icon abruptly stepped down as executive chairman of WWE parent TKO Group Holdings, penned a lengthy email to McMahon dated December 24, 2021, in which she called him, quote, my best friend, my love, and my everything. After almost 3 years together, it's like my life isn't even real to me unless you're there and in it, and I'm sharing it all with you, Grant wrote on Christmas Eve to 78-year-old McMahon, obtained by the Post. They have the entire letter there, and Janelle Grant's lawyer, Ann Callis, did respond to the New York Post saying, frankly, it's pretty disgusting that Vince's weeks-late attempt to defend this horrendous behavior, behavior he claims to this day never happened, is to try to showcase letters that Vince himself coerced her to write. His psychological torture of her continues, as is typical of abusive predators who respond to women speaking out with increased threats. While Janelle isn't a stranger to his intimidation tactics, this is a new low even for him, end quote. And we're going to get further response from Ann Callis, but this is kind of the first act, I would say, from the Vince McMahon side outside of the denial of these accusations that were promptly made by Vince McMahon right after the lawsuit was filed. And since that time, Vince McMahon has kept a pretty much private profile since then. And while not directly speaking here to the New York Post, obviously this is giving an insight into their defense and moving forward with the case in a public fashion too.
And we can add, this letter was obtained apparently by the WWE board, but from their internal investigation that was conducted by the board, the article in the New York Post says Grant's laptop, the email was taken from Grant's laptop, presumably her work laptop, when she worked at WWE as part of an investigation on behalf of the WWE's board by White Shoe Law Firm Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett. So it's not clear if WWE cooperated with Vince to make this public, but that's where the letter comes from, is from Janelle Grant's laptop.
So we will hear the statements that we received. We reached out to all relevant parties in this, so you will hear that after the interview. But I think at this point, we're going to air the interview that we conducted. Again, this was done on Tuesday afternoon with Ann Callis. As our coverage of the Janelle Grant lawsuit continues, we are happy to welcome Ann Callis to the program. She is representing Janelle Grant in the ongoing suit against Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE. And thanks so much for joining us today to speak with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, you both, for your coverage of this. We appreciate it.
Well, we wanted to have you on to get a bit of an update on the case and also your reaction. We're speaking with you on Tuesday afternoon, so this is about 24 hours after the New York Post had released this story containing a letter dated December of 2021 by Janelle Grant to Vince McMahon. And you are quoted in the article as well, but just tell me a bit about your reaction to this move that appears to be coming from Vince McMahon's side of things.
Well, we weren't surprised. It was a tactic to intimidate Janelle and victim shame her. And serendipitously enough, during that period, we have been meeting with the foremost experts in sexual assault, in coercive control, in rape myths. And we are hiring the absolute best to explain the actions of a victim when they are under this coercive control. And they have testified in other trials of a similar nature very, very successfully.
Did you get the sense, first of all, what did you make of the timing of this move by... We're 2 months removed from the suit coming out. I mean, it's a hard question to answer, but do you have any theories on why now? WWE is obviously going into a pretty massive week this week with their big event in Philadelphia. What do you think the thinking was on that side of things?
I can't even speculate why they did that besides just to intimidate my client at the time.
And do you get the impression, based on what's in this New York Post article, it says that the letter was obtained from the WB board's investigation. So do you have any belief about how Vince's side got a hold of the letter? It was apparently taken from Janelle's work laptop at WB as part of the WB board investigation. Do you think there's any cooperation here between WWE and Vince to make this public?
I don't have any evidence of that. I just know that that Simpson Thatcher did not interview Janelle as a part of this investigation. She made herself ready and available, and they did not interview her.
Yeah, and that brings to mind Jeffrey Speed, who was the lead director on the investigation. He gave a comment to the New York Times, I believe the day that the lawsuit was filed, saying that there was outreach to Ms. Grant and engagement with her lawyer. Like, do you have any response to that? Is that true in any way?
I wasn't representing her at the time, but no, that is not my understanding. My understanding is she made herself available and they did not reach out to her.
But Janelle would have been open to participating in such an investigation.
Absolutely.
When you kind of look at the way that this suit has been received by the public, what have been some of your thoughts in terms of what you've learned about the WWE culture and sort of the response now that you have 2 months to have seen how this story has been handled and people outside and inside the company that have commented on Vince McMahon and other stories that have come to light?
Well, we have had a real, and I've said this before, an onslaught of people coming forward. Even as of yesterday, we still get people that want to speak that were witnesses. We are arranging a file on that. We are working really diligently to contact everyone back, make sure, times, dates, if they can remember. There are some similar stories. However, there is now non-public investigations going on. So some details I have to leave out.
Is there any chance that this could turn into a lawsuit that has multiple plaintiffs? Since we know that there are, by my count, about seven women with allegations of misconduct against Vince or John Laurinaitis. Is there any possibility that this could include more plaintiffs in the future?
That's possible. But right now, my focus is on Janelle and making sure that she's okay.
And how is Janelle Grant doing in light of all of this? And this is being covered very heavily throughout the media.
She's okay. For someone who, because of what happened to her, suffering from PTSD and other ailments, she's resilient. We've been on the phone and talking to her a lot. recently. So she's okay.
And reading the letter, there are some names, just first names that are mentioned, including Nick and Brad. And we reported through Front Office Sports last month that the officers who are mentioned in Janelle Grant's lawsuit are Nick Khan, who is the current president of WWE, Brad Blum, who is the current COO of WWE. Is it right to assume that Nick and Brad, who are referred to in the letter, are Nick Khan and Brad Blum?
Yeah, I think that's fair to assume that.
And there's other names too. There's a Mickey and a Paul. Do you have any information about who those people are?
I think Paul was, she referred to Paul Mangieri, who is an executive assistant, but we still have as witnesses coming forward, that a lot of executives knew what was happening and did nothing to intervene.
And I think a lot of people are wondering, since you know, Nick Khan allegedly knew about this, Brad Blum, do you have any information about whether Paul Levesque, who's the chief content officer of WWE, he had any knowledge of this before the board generally found out about the relationship between Vince McMahon and Janelle?
I can't comment on that now, just to say that we do have witnesses still coming forward of the knowledge of executives at the WWE.
Of those that you have heard that have been making the effort to reach out without naming names, do you get the sense that Vince McMahon is perceived now to be out of power, and this fear that I think a lot of people that have worked in that company, like this is a guy that ruled this company and was largely untouchable. Do you think that some of that has been alleviated now, that there is a feeling that people can move forward and speak more openly today? Or is there still that concern from some that you're hearing from?
Oh, I think there's still a grave concern out there. And I also said this before, when Vince McMahon left the company, that was a positive first step. But the circus-like atmosphere that contributed to this culture of corruption and victimization has to be addressed.
Do you know if any of the other executives in the company were aware of not only the relationship, but did they have any awareness of the abuse and the assaults that are alleged in the lawsuit?
I can't comment on that right now. We're still in the nascent stages, too, of our litigation.
Have all the parties been served at this point? And can
yes.
you give it? They have been served.
Yes.
And what are we looking at in terms of like the next steps? Like who is like what are the next actions that like Brandon and I should be focusing on, for instance? Like what are the big moments or events still to come and action to be taken?
Well, from serving the complaint, they have 60 days to answer. So that will happen within 60 days. And we'll proceed to litigation. We'll have our initial conference and start discovery.
So were WWE and Vince served around the same time as John Laurinaitis?
Everyone was served.
Okay,
yeah.
So that would put their due time to answer around sometime in the middle of May.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has there been any discussions through WWE? And are you like what comes out of the New York Post story is Vince McMahon has his representation. We know John Laurinaitis has his separate representation, and it would certainly seem that WWE will have their representation. Would that be a likely picture that we are painting here, that these three entities will have all different defenses? They will not be working together, you would assume.
I don't know.
And if I guess one more question, I'm not sure you'll be able to answer, but there's a lot of expectation around the notion that Vince is being investigated by some kind of federal agency, whether it's Department of Justice, SEC. Could you say anything about whether you and your client are cooperating with any kind of a federal investigation involving Vince?
I can't comment on a federal investigation.
You've obviously been, you know, you've worked in this field for so long. Is there a uniqueness about this particular culture that stands out in its own way? And when you were first approached by Janelle Grant, I mean, your own sort of reaction hearing these accusations for the first time, I mean, I'm sure you are somewhat, have heard a lot of graphic details in your time, but did this somewhat stand apart?
I try a lot of felony murder, rape cases as a trial judge. But yeah, this is of its own class, the depravity, again, the culture of corruption that allowed this to happen. I think the trier of fact will have a lot to listen to.
And was it a process for Janelle to get, like, we are just reading this horrific lawsuit, and I have to imagine that it was a bit of a journey for her to be able to attach her name to this and get into such grand detail. Was that a evolutionary process for her to mentally get to be ready to be such a public face attached to this that so few would want to be?
It took a while, but again, she does have great courage. She has been grievously damaged, but she does want to help any potential other victims, people who have suffered what she suffered. And she feels that, I think it was a bit cathartic for her, but also triggering and devastating in a lot of ways. I know I stayed with her with that complaint one day for about 9 hours with her. So it has been a long and arduous process, but we think we have a case that can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by a preponderance of the evidence.
And I guess just thinking for our audience who are mainly wrestling fans, if not completely wrestling fans, do you have any thoughts about how should WWE fans think about WWE these days, especially going into a big weekend where a lot of people are going to be watching WWE, and there's a lot of questions around the culture of WWE and what was allowed to have happened. I mean, do you have any suggestions for how WWE fans should think about this product, this entertainment product that's going to get a lot of attention this coming weekend?
Well, I would hate to put myself in the position of a fan because I never did watch WWE. Now I know a lot about WWE, but I think everyone can come to their own conclusions on what they witnessed themselves.
My last question is just taking it from the perspective of someone that reads this letter from 2021 and believes that this just reads as a woman that was in love with this man that doesn't fully understand the coercive element that could be involved here. For people that are maybe not as educated on that fact, I mean, what do you read from this letter that starts off by listing, like, this is the 24th draft of this letter? And obviously this was a strategy from their part that was to convey that viewpoint, but you're seeing a lot of mixed reaction to this, that it's proven the opposite for some. And
right. I think it's not a mitigating factor at all for Vince McMahon. It's further proof of misconduct. Everyone knows about fight or flight. Why didn't she fight? Why didn't she or he who's being assaulted? But there's also freeze and appease, where people just get frozen and then caught and then feel more and more trapped. And the fact that she, what I read when she kept redoing the letter and kept editing the letter, it wasn't love. It was fear of repercussions. She wanted to get this letter right for him because she was very fearful of any negative repercussions. And she was, frankly, an emotional prisoner and was asked to do this by Vince McMahon. And she, by then, did what she was told. But again, I think we could we'll have our experts be able to expound more on why she felt this way, why victims of sex trafficking do this. It's been done before. R. Kelly, there were letters. The Ranieri case, there were letters. Epstein, this isn't a new thing like gotcha. It happens when people are sex trafficked. And intimidation of my client and to try to shame her.
All right. Well, Anne, you've been very generous with your time. I want to thank you very much for joining us, giving us the latest on the case and your perspective. And thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks a
lot.
Bye.
So that was our interview with Ann Callis, who is the legal representation for Janelle Grant. And there was a lot in that interview. We were limited with time with her, but I thought like there were several important parts to that conversation, Brandon. Going in order was kind of the clarification of Janelle Grant and her willingness to take part in the WWE's investigation that was primarily concluded by November of 2022.
Substantially
completed. Yes. Let's get all the proper wording in. It is worth noting, though, Janelle Grant was represented by a different lawyer at that time. Jeffrey Speed had stated there was outreach to Janelle Grant's side, and ultimately she did not participate in the investigation, but through Ann Callis stating she was certainly willing to take part in such an investigation.
Yeah. So the quote from Jeffrey Speed, who was an independent member of WWE's board of directors, he was the lead independent member involved in the internal investigation, the special committee investigation. And as we know, Janelle Grant says that she wasn't reached out to, she wasn't interviewed, no documents were requested from her. And Jeffrey Speed told the New York Times later that evening after the lawsuit was filed that I remain confident in our investigation, which included outreach to Ms. Grant and engagement with her lawyer. So her lawyer would be a different lawyer other than Ann Callis at that time. But that's, I mean, these parties are on very different pages in terms of whether or not there was actual engagement with Janelle Grant for the investigation for the board.
Yeah, she did mention that all the parties have been served between WWE, Vince McMahon, and John Laurinaitis, and that there's about a 60-day period for the parties to respond. Which
May 14th is Laurinaitis' due date, and if they were all served on the same day, it's not in the docket, but if all were served on the same day, they would all have the same due date of May 14th.
Yeah, and she explained that from there, they would proceed to litigation, they would initiate a conference and then move to the discovery process if the timeline stays intact. And mentioning several of the names as well that were listed in that letter by first name only, you had Nick and Brad that I think everyone assumed was Brad Blum and Nick Khan, and Ann Callis seems to believe that would be accurate. There was also the names of Paul and Mickey that we understand to be Paul and Mickey Mangieri. Paul was an executive assistant, and it seems like Mickey had, we're not sure if this was a father-son, what the relationship was between the Mangieris, but holding similar positions with Vince McMahon.
And both we believe, were executive assistants to Vince McMahon.
Yes.
Yes.
And there was also a chef who we don't know his identity.
We don't know about the chef.
The chef.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, just some other things I took just was the fact of her, like Ann Callis, you can research.
If I could jump in. So Paul Mangieri, an executive assistant to Vince McMahon. So a lot of people speculating that the Paul, it was just the first name Paul that was in the letter, is that Paul Levesque? As people just heard in the interview, we specifically asked about Paul Levesque. Ann Callis could not comment as to whether Paul Levesque was aware of the relationship before the rest of the board was aware, as allegedly Nick Khan and Brad Blum were. So we don't have an answer to that.
That's right. Yeah. And just stating the fact that, you know, this is a unique case just in that this is like the depravity listed here is in its own class, which covers a lot of ground. If you have done your research onto Ann Callis and some of the cases she's been involved with as well. So those were some of the key takeaway points from that interview. Brandon, we also reached out to the legal representation for Vince McMahon, as we did with John Laurinaitis, and we did get responses back from each of those sides.
Yes, we asked WWE also. We have not gotten a response yet from them, but we do have some written comments from Jessica T. Rosenberg, who is the attorney for Vince McMahon. She's a lawyer from the Kasowitz firm, who actually just were litigating with WWE with the MLW lawsuit, but we do have some comments from her, as well as John Laurinaitis' lawyer, Edward Brennan. So I don't know which one you want to go to first.
Let's go to Vince McMahon's side first.
There we go.
So this is the statement from Jessica Rosenberg. Ms. Grant wrote this love letter to Mr. McMahon. Her attorney is now desperately trying to explain it away because it shows the relationship was consensual and the lawsuit's allegations are a sham. The false explanation that it was coerced is nonsense.
And then there's more.
Ms. Grant's letter is multiple pages, includes details of their relationship, and indicates she wrote 24 drafts. It makes no sense to coerce someone to write 24 drafts of a multiple-page love letter. And it finishes off by stating that Ms. Grant's letter is just one piece of evidence demonstrating the relationship was consensual and her allegations in the lawsuit are false. There are more pieces of evidence like this to come that will prove her claims are meritless.
Eager to see it. Maybe there'll be something in an exhibit, perhaps from Vince McMahon's side that, you know, shows, you know, purportedly supports the notion that this was a consensual relationship. That's something you can imagine is when there is a response by May 14th. Oftentimes it is on the due date that we get the response, that maybe there'll be some sort of material that's made public as a result.
Yeah. I think this would be the first example of Vince McMahon's side, how aggressive it expects to be. Like, this does paint a picture that there is going to be a very contentious battle coming through. And the idea of there's a lot more where this came from, and the fact that they are like, I look at this New York Post story, like this letter is, it's interesting just to see the tactic at hand of releasing this letter. And you can have both sides that are going to be arguing over the language that we see right there. You have one side that is looking at 24 drafts of a letter. That sounds pretty bizarre for that amount of drafts to be made of a letter. And you have Vince McMahon's side that is arguing, how could you coerce someone to make 24 drafts of a letter? So, I mean, I don't think you're getting any black and white answer just based off of this letter. You can interpret it however you want, but it's just interesting that, you know, one side believes this is a point in their corner and the other side thinks it is only fuel for their side.
And I think what Vince's side is raising or will raise is that this letter was written December 24th, 2021. So remember, the NDA was agreed to the following month in January. So this is pretty late in the relationship, which is narrated throughout that complaint of, you know, starting in 2019 all the way to early 2022. So this is pretty late in the relationship, after there are all these assaults that are described in the complaint. So I imagine that what McMahon's side will argue is that how can, you know, these claims be true when she wrote this love letter in December of 2021.
I guess we should also, before we get to Edward Brennan's statement, also include the portion from the New York Post story. They do have a screenshot of a text exchange between Janelle Grant and Vince McMahon, with Janelle Grant showing off her left hand and had a surgical procedure on her left finger, stating that, "I think I'm tapping out today." And then follows up by, "How will I write your letter? I can type and read it or try to write it in a couple of days. I'm so sorry if I messed this up. I want you to have a nice letter." So there's nothing in this text exchange of Vince McMahon demanding that she write this letter, but it is a subject, obviously, of some concern for Janelle Grant to complete this letter. And that could have been on her own volition, or it could be something that she was expected to do. You can read that however you want, but this was showcasing the fact that, you know, she's writing this letter and has just gone through a surgical procedure on her finger as well.
Right. And this is around the time of Christmas, so it's not clear if this is a Christmas gift request or what it is.
So Edward Brennan as well gave us a short statement as well when we reached out to him. Edward Brennan again is representing John Laurinaitis. And Edward Brennan writes, "My client and I are satisfied that when all the facts become known, Mr. Laurinaitis will be vindicated from the allegations leveled against him." "Judge Callis was a learned judge and is a skilled litigator. I anticipate she will ultimately see that Mr. Laurinaitis is, like her client, a victim in this case, and Judge Callis will do the right thing and dismiss my client from this lawsuit. In the event she does not, my client will clear his name and reputation in court, not in the media."
Yes. Ann Callis was a judge in Illinois, is what's being referred to there.
That's right. Yes. So, but as of now, John Laurinaitis, still a listed defendant on this, in the civil suit. And that kind of just brings us to the present and where things stand now. I mean, we are still over a month away before any of these parties will have to respond. And I guess it's something to watch of if other parties decide to play any of this in the media in terms of any other disclosures or anything like that, as we saw with the New York Post this past week, and if that's going to be a tactic moving forward. And I don't think it was lost on people as well, this timing, that this does bring this case back into the forefront of people this past Monday, as WWE's going into a gigantic week where either this is going to get swept up in all the other wrestling news among people that are following the product, or it's going to be something that is topical that is going to be brought up more. Like we have some examples just this week of, you know, CM Punk and Cody Rhodes on the MMA Hour being asked about the case. Becky Lynch is doing the media rounds, and in almost all the interviews you see, she is being asked about Vince McMahon and the Janelle Grant lawsuit as well. So this is the time of the year when WWE talent are more front and center than any time of the year, and some outlets will be asking about it, and this does bring up new information.
Yeah, something else I want to point out here too, which I brought up earlier. It's unclear if or to what degree WWE cooperated with getting this letter out. It's from the board's investigation. It's from Janelle Grant's WWE laptop. The letter itself, if I'll show from the New York Post article, has a notation at the bottom, WWE dash, which is presumably supporting the notion that it's from the WWE board's collection of material related to the investigation. If there was any cooperation, I mean, the argument against WWE wanting to help Vince get this out would be, why would you want something like this out on WrestleMania week, the week leading up to WrestleMania, when there's going to be so much attention directed at WWE, when you're trying to go into this great event that you're hyping and want to paint as positively as possible? So I don't have an answer to that, but it raises questions.
Yeah, I think it's a hard one to draw any conclusions, because at least the public stance has been a very very clear distancing of itself from Vince McMahon and not wanting to be sharing any headlines with Vince McMahon in any way, shape, or form. But I guess that's the latest. Was there anything else that you had coming out of the interview and any of the statements, any larger thoughts?
I think we covered it all there. We spoke to everyone. Again, WWE did not respond to our request for comment, but I'm glad that we got three of the four parties to you know, contribute to the story.
Yeah, we also have a written version of the interview and comments from everybody up at WrestleNomics.com and PostWrestling.com if you want a written version as well. And we will be isolating the interview with Ann Callis on our channels on top of that. But there's a lot to get to, and we will move on. CM Punk was on the MMA Hour on Monday. Did you happen to have two free hours, Brandon, to sit down and watch the state of CM Punk for one of his landmark?
I listened to most of it live, and it's definitely overwhelming, the news surrounding the New York Post story and the Janelle Grant letter to Vince McMahon. But yes, I did listen to it mostly while it was going on.
Well, you know what? Before we get into kind of the more AEW specific topics, let's tie up our discussion on Janelle Grant by getting Punk's reaction here to the case filed by Janelle Grant, the allegations, and CM Punk's reaction to Vince McMahon.
I didn't read all the allegations. I read text messages and I went, oh, fuck this. Like, what? It's indefensible, you know? And I think, you know, doing this, I'd imagined I was going to be asked about it, you know? And I think the easiest thing for people to do is to kind of ignore it or avoid it. But man, it's there. And my initial first thing out of my mouth was, I'm kind of shocked at how dumb he was, like writing stuff down and leaving that paper trail. And it's horrific. And I'm not like, I think at this point, all the energy should be used to somehow, I don't even know if you can make reparations or amends, but there's victims here, you know? So like what CM Punk thinks about Vince and the CM Punk Vince relationship doesn't fucking mean anything. All that stuff takes a back seat. I'm more concerned about, like, going forward, how do those people survive after suffering all that trauma?
So that was CM Punk. I would say of the people in WWE, this is pretty much the most outspoken I think anyone has been, like, that
clear. Short of Ronda Rousey, I suppose.
Yeah, I would
say in WWE.
I'd call her very much ex-WWE by this point. But yeah, I mean, pretty steadfast in terms of his opinions of Vince McMahon. And you can certainly look that I don't expect too many wrestlers, whether they're in or out of WWE, to really be exploring the larger kind of culture issue at WWE. And I'm certain that a CM Punk, given all of his time in this company, was pretty outspoken about the environment in WWE. But I mean, it was very clear there in terms of his just disgusted by the text messages alone, that I think many people, that's disqualifying in and of itself. Forget any of the more graphic details of the lawsuit. The text messages alone are, this guy is unfit for employment in this company.
Yeah, I always think of how UFC fighters, you can probably inform this, UFC fighters are much more willing to criticize the company than WWE people are. And I would speculate that that's largely because of the fact that WWE is so much more subjective in terms of one person, one booker's decision about what kind of matches and what kind of push you're going to get. There's some latitude in UFC, but ultimately you get to go in there and you fight and you win or you don't. But there are clearly, and I think this is starting to improve slightly and change, in that people who have more status in WWE are able to speak a little bit more freely. And certainly Punk would be on the higher end of that in terms of, because he's a higher level star than a lot of others.
Yeah, I think so. I think that with a CM Punk, that I think it's also, like, we would be remiss that I think that the idea of anyone speaking out specifically about Vince McMahon right now, you're not going to draw the ire of the company, I would say, in this environment by speaking about.
And you're seeing Becky Lynch, I think, go there a little bit, not specifically about Vince, because she's calling him, you know, her father figure, things of that effect, and how she had a very different relationship with him, which I believe. But you still see, you know, a lot of hesitance to really, you know, to be more honest than I imagine. Maybe they really feel in their heart of hearts, or that Ronda Rousey is.
Yeah. And I always go back to the fact that regardless of how, I mean, I don't think anyone can carve a path of Vince McMahon back to WWE, but you have to remember, these performers, they saw this guy leave once and come back. And that's always got to be something in the back of your mind of, like, could Vince McMahon find his way back to this company if this case got settled? I mean, there's always going to be, I think, that thought that a McMahon cannot be that far away from power in WWE, even with something as giant as this case is, that seems to be the unchaining of Vince McMahon's link to this company.
Well, Class B shares are gone, so there is no immediate instrument for him to force his way back in, as he did in January 2023. But I do believe that there are people who believe that he will try to come back if you know, once this legal matter is settled or whatever happens here. But I think it's very, very difficult for Vince to try to come back. You would have to get a lot of you have to get Endeavor on his side. Basically, Endeavor owns 51-52% of this company and controls the company. So without support from Ari Emanuel and people like that, I don't see how it could happen.
Punk also spoke about AEW. You remember he worked for AEW.
Was
for
he there? Oh.
Yes. Okay. He was there for 2 years, had some time there, and got to give his thoughts on many of the issues that led to his release last September following the All In
event.
You know, he just felt, you know what, I've had my run here. I think things are good. And, didn't punch anyone, just choke someone out a little bit.
Yeah.
Choke them a little bit. It happens in work environments. But here is CM Punk giving his assessment on AEW.
It's always going to exist as long as Tony wants to put money into it.
Okay. But can they be as successful? Like, do you feel like they're trending? Do you watch them even?
What's successful, though? Like, what's the definition? See, this is what I'm talking about, like, levels, you know, because, like, I started on the indies. And to me, successful was, I can eat tonight. I have gas money to get to wherever I was going. And man, I had a good match, you know? And then, you know, you get to television, and as somebody coming in who doesn't know jack shit about doing television, like, I have to lean on people and ask questions and watch and learn and grow. And a lot of people, I think, are still just stuck in that indie mindset. And again, it's where I came from. Mm. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you're more happy with some goof saying that you had a five-star match and the building's a quarter full. We're not in the same business.
Right.
So, I mean, an unintended target there. Poor Norm Dooley and his five-star ratings.
Norm Dooley invented the star system, right?
Yes, yeah. With Jim Cornette. So I'm sure that's who Punk was referencing there. So this, I mean, I think this was music to any WWE supporters' ears this week, because it was not only this big Punk interview, but I think he vocalized what a lot of detractors of AEW may have to say, and it's led to the referendum. Is AEW a real business? And thankfully, we have the person here that could best answer that question. Is AEW a real business, Brandon?
It's a limited liability company, in fact. It's a business that exists. I think it's an LLC in Florida. It's a business. They generate revenue. They probably do not generate net income or other generally accepted accounting principles versions of profit measurements. But it generates revenue. The notion of whether it, and I think there's a lot of other comments. I don't think we're going to play all the clips that are relevant to this subject, but he makes the point. Are we playing the clip about him saying that they should be paid on the house and guaranteed money is ruining wrestling?
We don't have that one, but okay. He does make the comment that guaranteed money he feels has ruined wrestling to some extent.
And that's, I mean, those models are applicable to both WWE and AEW, and basically largely only those two companies, right? In terms of they're benefiting so heavily, so overwhelmingly from media rights fees, and the old model of hype and, you know, selling tickets and or pay-per-views for that matter is less important. Yes, AEW does pay-per-view business, but it's a smaller part of their business compared to media rights value. But yeah, I mean, like, everybody is paid a guaranteed downside. Certainly in AEW, I believe there's, you know, they're basically guaranteed a certain amount of money, and if they go over the number of dates that they're supposed to do, then they get paid extra or something like that. But it's a different business than it was a long time ago. But I think there should still be ample motivation to create hype. You're still, at the end of the day, promoting fights, worked fights, but you're still promoting matches that you have to make people want to see. So there should still be some incentive if it's less direct than before, because you're not trying to sell a ticket for tonight with the same urgency that you were in the territory era, where you were in a TV studio saying, come down to the Omni tonight. But we're still promoting fights that people want to pay to see or spend their time to see. So the notion of talking people into the building, I think, still applies.
It'd be an interesting question for a CM Punk in this era of guaranteed money. If you're the one that are selling these pay-per-views and you're the one that are talking these people into the buildings and making sure that this week's television rating is bigger than the last one, should you directly have a share in any of that revenue that is afforded you?
Or someone who collectively bargained to make sure that you had a certain share. But I mean, like, to the point that AEW or AEW's leadership doesn't care about drawing money, I mean, they have to draw strong TV ratings in order to justify a strong upgrade in media rights value in order to become profitable. But I accept Punk's point that, well, maybe Tony will just run it as long as he wants to run it, because his family can certainly afford to do so. But I do believe, obviously, there's a genuine intent to make this business financially successful, which means profitable, which I highly doubt it is now. But if AEW gets a strong enough new TV deal, which I predict they will, they'll get a strong enough increase in TV rights fees to become a profitable company somewhere in the late 2020s.
Yeah. And I think that is the larger aspect of, like, is the business healthier or less healthy than 2018 in a pre AEW industry? And the fact is that CM Punk, like, on his last day in AEW, wrestled in front of more people than he has ever wrestled in front of in his entire career.
He went on top.
Yes. Though you do have to check the turnstile count for.
He did mention the turnstile count. I caught that. Yeah.
Yes. And only looks at, you know, his Instagram. That's about all he goes on and checks out what is it? Accounts of like dogs and stuff like that. I would love to know what his URL history looks like.
I've argued that dogs or pets should be the only accounts that are allowed on social media, because only dogs and cats and other domesticated animals have proved that they are mature enough to handle social media.
Is there tribalism among pet enthusiasts? Is there like dogs and cats? Do they?
If there's money to be made in tribalism among dogs and cats, there is tribalism.
Okay, well, maybe this is some unexplored territory we can look into. But we're going to pivot, and we will be getting back to other news items. But there's a little event called WrestleMania that is coming up this weekend, and we are going to have a slew of shows happening in and around Pennsylvania. And maybe the most unique show is going down on Thursday night with a special tribute show in honor of the late Dean Rasmussen. And we're going to be joined now by the promoter over at Action Wrestling, Matt Griffin, who is joining us, the CEO of the company, who, if I'm not mistaken, is joining us from the Philadelphia Phillies game as we speak. Hello, Matt.
Yes, in theory, we're going to have a Philadelphia Phillies game, but the tarp is on the field and there are pools of water on it. And I'm not a betting man who's, I don't think they're playing today, but this is definitely the most unique atmosphere I've had for an interview.
Well, every wrestling fan that's attending Lincoln Financial Field on Saturday or Sunday is a bit more scared now as the weather.
Oh, yes, it is quite miserable out here. I hope it's better by this weekend.
So, Matt, tell me a little bit about this undertaking. And for those that are maybe listening that don't know about Dean Rasmussen and his influence to a whole generation of professional wrestling fans, if you could just explain a little bit about how this idea came together and a bit about Dean himself.
Well, to talk about Dean himself, it sounds like I'm going to make myself very dated and old, but, you know, pre-Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, if you wanted to watch wrestling matches that weren't on TV, you had to go ahead and, you know, tape trade. You had to go ahead and get a fourth generation tape from Japan, or, you know, trade matches from the 90s with Sabu and the Lightning Kid and all of that if you wanted to see matches. And that's kind of one of the places that the Death Valley Driver video review board started. They were huge fans of wrestling, and most of the type of wrestling that was not readily seen, like independence, Japan, Mexico. And yep, there's the page right there. It was a very classic message board. There were a lot of wrestlers who were on the board itself. Dean Rasmussen was one of the founders and one of the main influencers. He would do road reports from shows he went to in the Virginia area. I was based in Virginia while I was in the Marine Corps for my first few years, and I got to know Dean coming to shows, 25 years ago. Man, I feel old. And Dean was a great guy, talked very, very enthusiastically about the wrestling he saw, what he liked. But not just that, he told other people about it and got other fans on board. I eventually became a wrestler at a place called NWA Wildside, which was probably the most influential promotion in the Southeast. It's where AJ Styles, Ron Killings, Austin Creed, now Xavier Woods, they began, and so many more, their careers in that promotion. And it was those type of places, people talking about it, trading tapes, where you were able to go ahead and see different things. And Dean was a really great guy, just super enthusiastic about wrestling, and he would just try to get others on board to see and watch what he liked.
Yeah, and man, I was actually kind of a casual Death Valley Driver message board poster and reader, so I was dabbling. But I understand this card that you put together here for Thursday it's really inspired by Dean's taste, and I was wondering if you could tell us about that.
Well, It definitely veers toward the eclectic. We joked. I think nothing says it more than the last match that I released for it, which we entitled Three Flippy Guys versus Three Strong MFers. I don't know if we can swear on your show, so I won't.
CM Punk already did.
And that's Rico Gonzalez, Bobby Flacco, Braden Toon, who are three great up-and-comers from the Southeast, versus three big, strong motherfuckers from the Northeast, Danny DeMonto, Hoodfoot, and Isaiah Broner. We joked, we want some big guys against some small guys. We want some bodies getting thrown. We want some lariats, clotheslines. We were trying to think of kind of the funkiest card we could think of. And we've just got an absolute classic wrestling match on top with Timothy Thatcher and Daniel Maccabi renewing their rivalry. They had an absolute classic set of matches that are available on YouTube now from the Pacific Northwest in 2016, 2017, 2018. And, you know, we've just got, I mean, we have luchadors coming. I mean, the fact that we have Dr. Cerebro versus Gringo Loco on the show is just, I literally look at that graphic and I don't believe that's a match that's going to be happening tomorrow night. You know, I run Action Wrestling. I have my, Action World champion, Alex Kane, who was recently the MLW champion. You know, he's defending the title against Colby Carino, which is interesting. And I tell this to Colby all the time. I watched your dad growing up. The first independent wrestling show I went to in Virginia when I was starting to break in when I was 19 years old, it was Steve Carino and Julio Sanchez on the show. So this is a show that really in history to us kind of spans decades. And I'm real happy we can show it off. I hope it's what I hope we see tomorrow, what I see in my head it being. You know, we just want to honor kind of the fandom of wrestling history for the last 25 years. That's through Death Valley Driver, through Dean, through everybody who ever traded a VHS tape trying to see something new.
You've also got Slim J that's on the card. And, you know, unfortunate news this past week with the AEW cuts, but it has given people an excuse to really go into, like, this guy that has been wrestling for over 20 years. And I mean, someone that you can speak to personally of someone that's just been, you know, such a stalwart of like the Georgia independent wrestling scene. And I think that there's going to be a lot of interest just to see him coming out with this match with Adam Priest on Thursday.
I will say that my heart fell. I got a message on Monday. My heart fell when I saw that Slim J and Anthony Henry were both released. Both have been at Action Wrestling. Anthony Henry was my champion. He won the title. Slim J is somebody that I go back to the Wildside days with. I teamed with him. I wrestled against him. I know exactly how good Slim J is. And it felt great to see when he was becoming on AEW a few years ago. And I was hopeful he would really break out and become the superstar that I know he is. Unfortunately, that run didn't last as long as was wanted, and I think he definitely didn't scratch the surface of what he's able to do, whether it's character-wise or in-ring-wise. And Slim J is going to be wrestling Adam Priest tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Adam Priest is the first two-time Action World Champion, and I think he's the best wrestler in the Southeast and maybe the country to never have signed a contract with anyone. Adam Priest is the type of wrestler I can put with anybody, anywhere on the card, and they come away, whoever his opponent is, being like, oh, shit, that guy is really good, and he should not be on the indies anymore. I don't foresee it being too long before Adam gets to go do other things. He got to tour Germany last year and the UK last year, and hopefully there's a really good match happening tomorrow night with Adam and Slim J.
And this event, it's also going to be streaming at independentwrestling.tv, and we'll get all the information out in the show description as well. But it's happening at 8 p.m. Eastern time at the H2O Wrestling Center. And tell us just a little bit about promoting a show during WrestleMania week. It's obviously the biggest week of the year. It's also the most competitive week of the year. How are you feeling 24 hours out from the show?
I feel great. I was able to do this in 2021. We partnered up. We were one of the promotions who had a show in Tampa. ICW and Danny DeMonto were the leads that weekend 3 years ago, and we had a fantastic show then. I was extremely happy with. Thankfully, Matt Tremont and H2O extended the invitation to do it again this year. I thrive under competition. We have a Thursday night at 8 o'clock. I'll be honest, it's a very competitive time slot. I'm well aware of what other shows are happening that day and in that 7 to 8 o'clock starting time frame.
There were some talents that we could not secure because they were booked elsewhere. As funky and eclectic as this card is, we had ideas that would have made it even way more interesting. And maybe we'll get to them in the next year or two. But I thrive on this. I feel like we have an incredibly competitive card. We have 11 matches that are really cool. I think everything can bring something to the table. And what's great about WrestleMania weekend, especially any show where you stream live, you get that instant feedback. I know 45 seconds after a match happens, I can look on Twitter and social media and see the reaction to it. You know, people are going to tweet, "Oh man, that was awesome." And I, you know, people are gifting it, and it's something that's happening in the moment and everybody's watching it together. You know,
taking me back to my days in uncharted territory with Beyond. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're taking me back to my days with uncharted territory and Beyond. Yeah.
Oh, uncharted territory and Beyond. It was great days. Hey, we had a great uncharted territory down in the Southeast too, a year and a half ago when it happened in Chattanooga. You know, I think WrestleMania weekend is kind of a chance to go ahead and say, "Hey, this is what I like. This is what I do." We're in the Northeast. You know, Philly is a long way from Georgia, and Tennessee, where I normally am running shows. So I want to come up here, land, make a great impression, and show everyone, you know, what we have in the Southeast. And it's not just a Southeast type show up here. We have wrestlers from Germany. We have Robert Dreisker, Lawrence Roman coming in from WXW. We have wrestlers from Canada. We have Satan Sinner from Prestige Wrestling. Of course, we have Dr. Cerebro. We have Damus coming in. We have Mad Dog Connolly from the Midwest. I mean, we have just an insane lineup. I've been trying for 2 days to really put pen to paper and come up with how the matches should be ordered, and I'm completely lost as how to do it. I'm completely lost. It's a show where just about any match could go anywhere. And, you know, I mean, heck, we haven't even mentioned the fact that the independent world title is on the line with, Cruel defending against Warhorse, the longest, running champion ever. So, this card is, you know, it's cliche to say it's full of bangers, but I really believe everything will deliver up and down the line. I have a lot of faith in our core guys. I have a lot of faith in the wrestlers that we're bringing in for the first time.
We'll leave it on this note. You mentioned that a lot of wrestlers came up on the Death Valley Driver board, a lot of influential people in wrestling media as well, including one David Bixenspan. What was your earliest memory of a young David Bixenspan on the Death Valley Driver message board?
Oh man. I became friends with David, talked about him on the board, and not specifically on the board, but I do remember very specifically listening to a interviewer named Dave Meltzer interviewing and having Missy Hyatt on, and just a guest asking a completely inappropriate question to Missy Hyatt and Sonny. David Bixenspan is the next caller. Dave Meltzer says, "Oh, David, please save my show." So David replies, well, what do you want me to do? Ask about pride or something?" And it just got a complete belly laugh because David is an incredibly dry person and he's hilarious. We met. The DVDVR board was just so influential because there's so many wrestlers and so many people I found. Even today, just running the show, we find out so many people. It's like, "Yeah, I was a lurker on the board. I went to go check it out." Like, holy crap. That's very cool to be running the show and hearing 2 decades later people talking about how that board and how that scene influenced them.
There's a future documentary, I feel, that down the road into it. But last thing, Matt, where would you like to send people if they're in and around Philadelphia, can make it out on Thursday night? Where can they go for tickets? And we'll have all the information in the description, too.
Well, if you're coming to Philly, definitely don't come check out the baseball park, because I don't think any baseball is getting played today. But our show is Thursday. There will be tickets available at the door. It's Thursday night, 8 o'clock p.m. It is at the H2O Wrestling Center in Williamstown, New Jersey. And perfect, right there. The website, you can go right to actiondean.com and pick up tickets. We do have some available. We will also be streaming, like you talked about, live on IWTV if you're not able to make it out.
We'd love to have you as part of our viewership. And you can follow us along on Twitter. It is Wrestle, WRESTLE, action, and the number one. And just everybody, thanks for watching wrestling. Thanks for supporting independent wrestling on this huge weekend. It's it means a lot to those of us who've been in this business for decades, I promise.
Well, the lineup looks outstanding, Matt. Thanks so much for taking some time out. I hope the rain alleviates and you get some baseball today. But all the best with the show coming up on Thursday night. It looks really great on paper.
Hey, great to talk to you guys. Thanks so much for having me on. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
That was Matt Griffin joining us. Again, you can go to actiondean.com for tickets, and it'll be streaming on IWTV as well. So a lot going on over the next couple of days. And we'll hit off on some other news and notes before we wind things down here. I guess just putting a pin on this on the CM Punk discussion. Were you surprised at all of just how much Punk went into the AEW stuff? I mean, we got the confirmation, I mean, that we kind of had been aware of about the NDA as it relates to the All Out 2022 situation. Obviously, no restraints when it came to the Jack Perry discussion. He went into lots of detail in that sense. And I mean, kind of just, you know, the big focused upon aspects, I think, were his thoughts on AEW. And Cody Rhodes on Ariel's show today, having pretty much a 180 when it came to his experience at AEW.
More diplomatic Cody Rhodes, contrast.
Much more diplomatic Cody Rhodes, yes.
Yes. We know that there's an NDA specifically around the fight that occurred after All Out 2022, and apparently not an NDA surrounding anything else. He also made it sound like he might have gotten hurt as a reason. Ariel asked him if he had torn his triceps in the match or in the fight, and he sort of threw his hands up and said he can't say, or he didn't know, he wasn't sure. So, I mean, that was, I always assumed that he just got it hurt in the match, and he knew that he was injured at the press conference, but not clear.
All right, some other notes. WWE announced Clash at the Castle on June 15th at the OVO Hydro in Glasgow, Scotland, and they will be doubling up with SmackDown the night prior, and I would think if they're going to Scotland, they're going for a nice fee that will be attached to it from the local municipality, government of sorts. And then, you know, they've got the shows in France, in Saudi Arabia, Money in the Bank in Toronto, and then they won't have another US PLE until SummerSlam in Cleveland. And then they're going to Berlin for the end of August show.
I would think they also have to squeeze in a Saudi Arabia show in the spring that there's no date for, as far as I know.
Dave Meltzer has reported May 25th for Saudi Arabia. So that has not been announced by the company yet, but that would be Double or Nothing weekend. That would seem to make sense. And that would put it about 3 weeks out from this Clash at the Castle event in Scotland.
Okay. Because it sounds like it's going to be a tight squeeze to fit all those events in and keep them 4 weeks apart, but maybe some of them will only be 3 weeks apart.
Yeah, you're looking at 3 weeks between Backlash and Saudi Arabia. 3 weeks later is Clash at the Castle, and 3 weeks after that is Money in the Bank. So yeah, we're going to be seeing some. I mean, hey, if you're willing to pay, we'll do weekly premium live.
More content is better.
Throw people on an airplane to parts across the world, and we'll just cash in our checks. Also, this week it was announced that Silver Lake is taking Endeavor private.
Yes,
is this the end of TKO? What does this mean, Brandon?
TKO is still a publicly traded company. In fact, today it's such a publicly traded company that its stock is up over $90 per share, which has not been in that zone in quite some time. So the stock market is really liking the fact that Endeavor I don't know if you call this finalized that it's going to be taken private, but it is more set in stone now that it's going to be taken private. I have little doubt that it's going to be. But you can still even buy Endeavor shares. I believe they're taking them private at about $27 a share, $27.50, something like that. But TKO shares, even, you know, since we've been on the air here, have even been climbing, and they've been climbing throughout the day. So TKO stock price is doing quite well. I don't know that it means anything. Like, okay, TKO is going to be controlled 52% by private equity. I don't know that matters a great deal, but TKO is still going to be a publicly traded company. We're still going to have quarterly investor disclosures, earnings reports, and things like that. We just won't have the redundant Endeavor call the following day.
So have you heard what Ari Emanuel gets out of this deal?
I saw Mark Shapiro gets a nice raise, but what about Ari?
Oh boy. I don't know if Mark Shapiro can add up to this. This is from SEC filings. Ari Emanuel is going to receive a $25 million asset sale transaction bonus and then quarterly payments from WME, which are equal to 2.5% of the quarterly net cash profits related to the agency representation side. So I don't know how you're parsing all of this, but 2.5%
he's getting paid on the house. He's getting paid based on the house that he draws, yeah?
Of net cash profits, which I don't think is insignificant. As is this, he will also receive ownership of an Endeavor private plane following the merger. And this is expected to be, the merger is expected to be completed by the end of Q1 2025. So he's going to get $25 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So $25 million, 2.5% net cash profits of their agency business, and a plane.
A plane.
Yeah, why not? If you can get one, yes. Go for it.
Yeah, so I guess it's going to reward everyone, the executives especially. And I understand that Mark Shapiro goes from a $3 million salary to a $7 or $9 million salary, so they're all going to benefit greatly. I mean, the thing with Endeavor, and you've probably been covering it, you know, following it more than I have since it's before the TKO merger, and Endeavor owned UFC when they went public in April 2021, the stock price didn't perform very well. I mean, throughout the entire timeline of Endeavor being a publicly traded company. And the impression was that, well, it's because it has UFC in it, and UFC is a violent sport, maybe. So they pulled UFC out of Endeavor and merged it with WWE. That completed in September. But the Endeavor stock really didn't do any better after that either. So I guess they figured, well, we'll just take it private then if they're not going to value us at the appropriate value.
Yeah, and I think that they were also leaning on that recent purchase of CAA as well as sort of a valuation of
not CAA. It's a different talent agency. CAA and Endeavor are not merged.
No.
I see.
CAA was purchased by the French like billionaire. It was like a $7 billion purchase of CAA that Endeavor was looking at. Like, listen, if that's the street value of CAA, we're greatly undervalued. That was their argument to the street at the time.
Are we talking about the ICM merger with CAA?
This was with Francois Pinault.
Okay, of course.
Does that name ring a bell? It was a $7 billion purchase regardless. People will fact check. But there you go. That is the latest on Silver Lake taking Endeavor private. And we will see if anyone else gets any planes distributed to them. The go-home edition of Raw going into WrestleMania did 1,784,000 viewers and a 0.59 in the 18 to 49 demo. So their audience was up 3% from the week prior and was their largest audience since February the 19th. This included the first hour that was commercial-free that did over 1.9 million viewers and a 0.65. And was the first half of Raw was going against that giant game between Iowa and LSU that did 12.3 million viewers on ESPN. Caitlin Clark is a draw. And that was followed by the UConn-USC game as well. So there was heavy basketball competition against Raw. Audience rose up slightly. The demo was down slightly from last week's 0.61. And Brandon, anything you have taken from the quarter hour breakdowns?
I mean, people are talking a lot these days about how well WWE is doing in terms of its TV ratings and its attendance. And I think this makes it official that we are at the beginning of a new boom era for women's college basketball. But it did really well considering it was against another sporting event that had 12 million viewers. This was the highest rating for Raw since the middle of February for both total viewership and the demo. And we can see the quarter hours here. This quarter hour, of course, these first three quarter hours had no ad breaks in them, but the second quarter hour was the peak and it did really well. And that is the Rock, Roman Reigns, and Seth Rollins segment.
Maybe 3-hour commercial-free edition of Raw. Is that going to be in the future?
I think that would help ratings. Maybe not ad rates, but ratings, yeah.
And then we also had this announcement, which is yet another announcement by WWE. They have partnered with Nutribolt. You're familiar with Nutribolt, right, Brandon?
No, but context clues tell me that must be the parent company of C4.
That is correct. They are the owner of C4 Energy, and today they have announced an expansion to their multi-year partnership that will see C4 Ultimate Energy, one of the fastest-growing energy drink brands in the United States, become the first-ever official energy drink partner of WWE. So Prime and C4, separate lanes, I guess? These are not competing energy drink companies? One is
there's no exclusive stipulations saying that you can't have both C4 and Prime Energy as your sponsors, apparently.
Well, what does this deal mean for you, the viewer? Well, this coming weekend, C4 will receive prominent branding and exposure across a wide range of WWE properties and premium live events, including WrestleMania 40 on Saturday and Sunday, where it will serve as the first ever sponsor of the WrestleMania Skycam, which returns to offer the WWE Universe a unique viewing experience. We're bringing back the blimp.
Can't wait. I mean, this is one of the things. Oh boy, I'm going to compare W and AEW. Who are some sponsors for AEW that you recognize, that you notice on TV?
Woo Energy Drink, DraftKings.
Definitely that. DraftKings. Yeah. TurboTax is a new one. They're sponsoring like the replays at least earlier this.
Yeah, yeah. They sponsored someone like getting dropped on their neck. I remember that. That was the first Intuit Tax replay.
But probably an area for growth, and we'll see a lot of sponsorship. Looking forward to seeing Prime Energy on the canvas, and more importantly, will wrestlers slip on the Prime Energy logo?
I'm going to say over under 1.5 slips. I'm going on the over. Okay, between both nights. Okay,
I hope it's printed right on the canvas so that it maintains the canvas texture. So it's still a coarse texture that you can hold your footing well on.
What about this as the parlay? Okay, over 1.5 slips on the logo. Plus, I'm going to add on specifics. The Rock delivers a people's elbow, slips on the Prime Energy drink, tears quad, next movie, The Smashing Machine, pushed to 2025.
Well, if we can get this program sponsored by DraftKings, FanDuel, whoever wants to message us and make the best offer, we can do that.
It was also mentioned in this press release, C4 will be the presenting partner of the WrestleMania Night 2 press conference and WWE's multi-day talent tryout as part of WrestleMania week. So I thought that was an interesting line. They're only sponsoring the Night 2 press conference. So I asked WWE, are we getting two press conferences like we did last year after each night of WrestleMania? And I was told that we will be confirming later this week. So I don't know if that means they are undecided about two press conferences, but I thought it was interesting in this press conference that they're only listing the one night. So I don't know if we're getting one press conference or two from WWE.
Or maybe they want to wait to see if they can sell a sponsorship for the first night.
That could be it. Maybe we'll get the new. Have you seen the new Prime flavored drink that they have put out? It's they've partnered with a KFC. KFC flavored Prime energy drink.
So someone's out with like a hot dog flavored seltzer, something like this. Yeah, it's probably just to get for exactly this result where we're talking about these disgusting drinks that people are manufacturing.
Yeah, I think they could trademark the term vomit, and that would probably be. Do you know how many Prime Energy drinks we're probably going to be handed trying to enter the stadium?
You think we'll get some? I've never had it.
I think they'll be handing them out. I won't be taking any, but I'm sure there's going to be plenty of giveaways. So there you go. That's all the latest news that is bringing everyone up to speed. This has been a very packed edition of the show. We had a lot to get to. So WrestleMania week, it pretty well starts tomorrow. There's several big shows going on. There is a DDT show happening. There's the aforementioned Action Wrestling Dean event on Thursday night. And we've also got the Mark Hitchcock Memorial Super Show that I'm going to on Thursday night as well. So that's all happening. What am I going to get? I'm going to get to see Los Boricuas against the Full-Blooded Italians.
Great.
This is pretty wild. Yes, this is quite the wild lineup. And then you're getting in on Friday. Brandon and I are both going to be at Supercard of Honor, and Tony Khan is doing a press conference or a media call, I should say, on Thursday.
He's doing a media call and a press conference, is what I've been told by AEW. There was some confusion at first about whether he was going to do a press conference after Ring of Honor, Supercard of Honor, but I'm told that he is. And there's going to be a media call tomorrow, Thursday, at 1 p.m. So you'll see people tweeting about that and so forth, and we'll have the audio out there as well.
Yeah, I guess we could end on that because we kind of vaguely referred to the AEW cuts as Slim J was one of the cuts. Is there anything meaningful you take from these cuts? I mean, it was more so a news story rather than any one particular person being let go, and more so just the fact that they happened. And this has been a badge of honor for Tony Khan that he has honored contracts until their expiration. And does this indicate a bit of a sea change that, you know, cuts are something that AEW performers can expect now?
And I'm not necessarily doubting it, but we know that this is not just a case of contract expiring at the same time. I don't know why they would. I suppose everybody's on their own unique schedule. And that this was a case of contracts being terminated ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that it is. Yeah. I mean, it's the only time that something like this has happened, right? Especially in a set of them, as opposed to there's been terminations, as we know, such as CM Punk. I know there's the issue with Anthony Henry has a broken jaw, correct?
Yeah.
That injury did not take place on AEW in an AEW ring. It happened on an indie show, I understand. So I think if it happened in an AEW ring, that'd be a different story. I think there's a question coming out of the CM Punk interview where he says that all of his surgery and treatment and rehab related to his torn triceps in 2022 was done on his own and that AEW didn't support him at all through that. Which he was contrasting to the support that WWE has given him for his other triceps injury. So I think that's a question. Is that true? Did CM Punk really not get any medical support from AEW related to that?
Yeah, I think you could certainly look at as well just the optics of the timing of doing these cuts the week of a big show that you've got coming up on Friday night. You're going to be putting yourself in front of the media, and obviously these are going to be questions that people have. And like, I don't really know the thinking. That's why I'd be more curious to hear, like, why now? Why these particular ones? It's not as though, you know, it's you're alleviating some contracts, but nothing that is earth shattering or anything. But regardless, I would say regardless what Tony Khan's public stance is about these cuts, I would say as an AEW performer, I don't have that same confidence that I would have like a week ago, knowing that unless I commit some, you know, egregious action, I'm going to see the end of my contract. I wouldn't be as sure of that if I was someone at a lower level at the very least.
Yeah. And I think AEW had a lot more talent. It has a lot more talent probably still than it needs. I remember doing a study at one point to say, you know, how many match spots is the average wrestler getting? And so to try to put it in as plain language as possible, WWE is using their wrestlers more frequently than AEW is, which in one sense is good that people can rest. But you've got a ton of wrestlers who you're all paying guaranteed money, by the way, and maybe you're not using them in the most efficient way. While balancing health, you're not using it very efficiently. So that's another stereotype that we could bring up. And then there's truth to it that AEW has signed a lot of wrestlers and a lot of them are lost in the shuffle.
Yeah. I mean, just going through the cage match profiles of all these cuts and like just the few matches that you're talking about, and most of them just at the ROH level, like not even like weekly matches that we're talking about. I mean, for some, yeah, it's the guaranteed paycheck, but there's also the people that are just, you know, they want to be wrestling more as well. So that's, you know, certainly an aspect to this entire thing.
And if we could squeeze this in, I know we don't need to play the clip, but I thought it was remarkable Punk's comment about how Tony Khan, he's not a boss, he's a nice guy. Which I think describes a lot of the issues, and in particular the issues that he had with Punk, in terms of, I mean, that's the impression that I get from how he appears, how Tony appears publicly, in that he's really supportive of wrestlers and of wrestling, and he wants to be people's friend. But I'm not sure that he's the leader that AEW needs to be more successful than it is, in terms of, you know, resolving issues for one thing, resolving conflicts between people such as Phil Brooks and the various members of the Elite.
Yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword in the sense that I think I would rather have someone that is making those efforts to connect with his wrestlers, but there also is a line that you need to be able to separate from. And I think we can look at the way this has played out, you know, Tony was trying to acquiesce to everybody. He was not believing like the fallout with the Elite side and the Punk side had to be a choice of I'm either with these guys or these guys. It's I'll do whatever I can to keep everyone under this umbrella. We'll buy a second umbrella for Saturday nights and we'll put him on that one. And it's perfect. And right. it was just trying to make so many people happy. But, you know, I think that's a very valid criticism you have of him. But I would say there's probably a lot, too, that have had the stresses of working under Vince McMahon that greatly appreciate this difference. But
yeah, I'll say Tony is brought a lot to a wrestling company that I think has helped make it successful. Well, money, of course, but also connections to television networks. His connections to the NFL, I think, helped with that. A knowledge of wrestling, especially an outside of WWE knowledge of wrestling, that I think has helped, at least at the beginning, AEW offer a strong alternative to WWE. And he understands and has studied wrestling in a way that, frankly, a lot of people in the business have not. And I think that has been to AEW's benefit. But there are issues around leadership, I think, in the company that are not properly delegated. I'm not sure if they're properly recognized. And I see this being an issue for AEW for the foreseeable future, maybe over time. You know, Tony will become a more tenured promoter and a more effective leader. But that I do believe that's an issue that exists today.
How much of his reputation is laying on this next set of negotiations? Like, this is, do we go so far as to say, like, this is make or break in terms of, like, what is AEW going to be? If they get the deal they're desired and it takes them into profitability, I think it silences a lot of this. Like, you can criticize the nuts and bolts of how the company is run and what it's presenting. But if they don't get the deal that they're looking for, then it's this like existential question of what are you?
You're funding a company that's not profitable and is not profitable in the foreseeable future.
And then, you're locked into many big contracts. It's not a case of, hey, we can just make some cuts and get like they have committed to a lot of major players for years, to come. Like I couldn't imagine what the talent
they could cut
are.
Costs. I imagine that the costs on this company are not too thin to cut from, and maybe they could cut costs and get closer to profitability if they got a deal that does not allow them to be profitable under their current budget, maybe. But yeah, I think it plays into the stereotype of this is the son of a billionaire who's funding this company. Is it really going to work out? I mean, again, to be clear here, I expect they're going to get a good enough deal, but that's in the hands of WBD and others.
Yeah. One other thing in relation to that, Sports Business Journal has noted that the NBA's exclusive negotiating window with Disney and Turner runs until April 22nd. And then in theory, the NBA could speak to whoever. And I mean, logic would state that Turner is going to, or WBD are going to figure out their NBA picture before other decisions and negotiations are settled. But, it's really hard to guess where these AEW talks go, but that will be an important date just to see how much you're carving up the NBA picture and what WBD's what their plate of basketball programming is going to look like in the next deal.
And you would think AEW is going to wait until their exclusive window has expired too, given they haven't signed a deal yet. But I do think getting your deal squared away, which is going to be much bigger with NBA if Turner is going to renew. But I think AEW needs to talk to others to possibly have leverage to get a better deal than perhaps they've already been offered by WBD, which may mean, you know, shopping one or two of their weekly shows to somebody else, like maybe Fox.
Well, there you have it, everybody. You're up to date. You have now gotten your whole fix of Pollock and Thurston this week. So again, want to thank Ann Callis for stopping by, as well as Matt Griffin from Action Wrestling. We will be down in Philadelphia, so I hope to see many of you there. We will be getting in later on this week. And Brandon and I, again, will be at the ROH show Friday. We're going to both nights of WrestleMania. If there's press conferences both nights, it's going to be exceptionally long nights. And I will be represented by a zombie afterwards, doing a show with Wei Ting. And Wei will carry me through that as I...
Are you doing a live Supercard of Honor post-show?
I don't know if we're doing it that night or the next morning. That's really going to depend on the ROH press conference.
You're going to be home late after the Supercard of Honor show, I'm sure.
Who knows?
If you're going to the press conference.
And tonight, we'll be live right after Dynamite for our go-home show before we go to the airport tomorrow. So lots to check out. Postwrestling.com as well as WrestleNomics.com. And if you have your Sunday morning ritual, it's being disrupted this Sunday because Brandon will be coming at you Monday?
So I gave this some thought. And in fact, you know what I'm doing? Have you heard about this eclipse that's happening?
Yes. My son's off school Monday because they want the children to
Same
avoid
here. The eclipse. Not that I have kids, but yes. Schools are closed in Buffalo on Monday. So the eclipse, the line of sight, whatever you call it, is like running right through Buffalo, and Buffalo's expecting all sorts of tourists. So I'm coming home to Buffalo, like right at the tail end of the eclipse window or whatever. So there's supposed to be terrible traffic and things like that. So I don't know if I might just do the show at the Buffalo terminal, but you know, subscribers, I'll let you know. I'll try to give you a heads up.
Patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And for all of our WrestleMania coverage, you can go postwrestlingcafe.com. We'll be doing daily shows once we get to Philadelphia, a show after Supercard of Honor, a show after the Mark Hitchcock Memorial Super Show, and then we'll be doing YouTube shows after both nights of WrestleMania. So lots to come over the next couple of weeks, and then, or days, I should say. It'll feel like weeks. And then Brandon and I are back next Wednesday in this same time and slot to chat about whatever is going on. We're going to break out WrestleMania. What will be the attendance figure for WrestleMania 40?
They might break if you listen to Sunday's show, they might set the gate record on each night, at least in terms of real dollars, real time dollars. Maybe not for inflation, but maybe
the record is 17.3 million.
You got it. Yeah. In 2016 dollars.
Okay. Well, we will see if they can hit that. It is not a cheap ticket. Like if you're looking on like just the secondary market to get in, like it's
secondary market's more expensive. Last I looked, you can get cheaper tickets first market through Ticketmaster.
All right. Well, Brandon, we'll have you covered for all of that. So that's it for us. Thanks for tuning in to Pollock and Thurston.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.